Welcome everybody to Mike TV. This is episode 34, in which we will be discussing Better Call Saul, season 5, episode 3, entitled The Guy for This. My name is Lisa. Joining me is Dean. Hello, Dean.
Hey, Lisa. How you doing this morning? You sound a little scratchy.
Yeah, so we're coming to you all late this week. Apologies for that. I am scratchy. I'm going through the change. It's happening to me. I'm pulling a Peter Brady. No, I've had the flu, believe it or not, in this day and age when everybody's so afraid of everything that's going on out there. And yes, I got the flu. It's been awful. I have lost my voice. This is really the best my voice has sounded in about 5 days. So here we are. So apologies, everybody. I am better. I'm on the mend.
You haven't been traveling to Italy or China or Iran or anywhere lately, have you?
Correct. Correct. Okay, I have not even left my house.
Good.
So I've kept my flu germs to myself. Everybody's very glad about that, except my husband. He's had it too. And so we've suffered together, but we're on the backside of this. We definitely decided we're going to get the flu shot going forward. Nobody wants to live through this.
No, the flu shot, that's how the government controls you.
Well, you know, that was always kind of my feeling, but I can't go through this again. I'm beginning to wonder if my voice will ever be fully restored, so we'll see. We'll see. We'll see how this sounds, everybody.
Yikes.
Welcome. We'll get through it. Dean, how about you? You ready to talk about some Better Call Saul, or we've got some other shows to discuss, I think, ahead of that.
Yeah, let's hit up some other shows real quick before we get into this week's episode. The big show I know both of us watched, which if you've been watching Better Call Saul on TV, hopefully you stick around, because right after this week has been two-night premiere of Dispatches from Elsewhere on AMC.
I love it. I love it so hard. It is a wonderful, wonderful show. Everybody, please watch Dispatches from Elsewhere.
This is such a weird genre of a show, too, because every time you think it's one thing, it kind of spins off into something else, which I like. And what it appears is, I guess the only way I can describe it, it's based off of a real thing in San Francisco in the early 2000s. There was this game called, or this company called the Jejun Institute, the Institute. And it was this real life ARG game where these people found these invites, or somehow looked into this thing where they found these invites, actually went to this building where they got this orientation and then were wandering the streets, looking for clues and looking for all this stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's kind of based off a real thing. There's a documentary called The Institute that's about it. I don't know where you can find it, but I kind of was looking into it earlier this week. But it is kind of based off a real thing. As far as media, it reminds me of a more jovial version of The Game with Michael Douglas. Have you ever seen that movie?
Yeah.
So
it is a character study. So far, the first two episodes have been actually named after two of the title characters, Peter and Simone, both of whom I enjoy greatly. Of course, Peter is played by Jason Segel.
Yeah, and he Simone created is, the show.
Yeah, and Simone is Eve Lindley. Is that her name? And they're both, what it's portraying in my mind is that they're both these kind of lonely recluse people who have emotional issues, to say the least.
Right.
Definitely issues, you know, being around other people. And so they're drawn into this mysterious game, and it's so weird and odd and delightful as they run around looking for clues, and weird shit happens to them. Yeah. I'm not even doing the show justice. It is just odd and bizarre and wonderful.
Yes.
And then there's two other characters whom we haven't done deep explores of yet, but I'm sure that's coming. I believe Janice is the next episode.
Yes.
Delightfully by Sally Field. She is just, you know what? She's wonderful.
Yeah, and then you have Andre 3000 as Fred Wynn.
Fred Wynn, which is great. We saw him at the end of the last episode getting into the trunk of the car,
right,
of the Jejun Institute. It's definitely, and then there is this weird kind of mystery between the two entities, the Jejun and the Elsewhere Society.
Yes,
right,
right.
So, love it.
And
love it.
So, from what it appears, is the first four episodes are kind of your character introductions. Like we said, the next one is going to be Janice, and then the one after that will be Fredwin. And okay, what is kind of cool about it is that when we met all these people at the beginning, they all four look at this game or whatever as something different. And yeah, I think it's kind of what's neat about it is it's, they look at it however it's going to almost kind of help their life or what their life is looking for.
Right.
So I'm, and as much as of a difference as we saw from episode one to episode two, I think we'll continue to see almost a complete different viewpoint of the show once we look in through Janice's eyes. And I'm really curious to look through Fredwin's, because he thinks the whole thing's he seems to be this conspiracy nut. So I'm, yes, sure it's going to be a lot darker when we get to his point of view for it, but that it's a pretty cool show.
It is. It's wonderful. So everybody check out Dispatches from Elsewhere.
And it checked my Legion box, because within the first two episodes, there was definitely a random dance number that included Bigfoot for some, yes, reason. So there's a dancing Bigfoot on the show.
I love, and it's so colorful. Yeah. I love just the found art nature of it, whether it be interpretive dance art or, you know, even the randomization, if it is random at all, but the way they all formed into their parties through the different paddles, the blue shades of the paddles. It's incredible. This is not a Dispatches from Elsewhere show, but Dean and I were saying, gosh, if only we could fit this one into our schedule too. There's a lot of mystery to unpack here. And just a lot of weird shit to talk about between the talking fish and the search for Clara. Anyway, so
speaking of weird shit and mystery, I also watched Debs, the Debs 2 episode premiere this week on FX on Hulu.
Right, Hulu exclusive for FX.
This is another show which is, it's, I don't, it, I think you would actually, you said you haven't watched it yet.
Not yet. I plan to.
I think you're going to like it, because it is not only, it's weird, but it's all kind of based around this tech company and almost like corporate espionage as well. And so it made me think that you'll probably like, cause it'll kind of fit your Mr. Robot mold.
Oh, okay, cool.
But it's really good. I have no idea what's going on. Some of the language they're talking about with coding and programming and stuff goes way over my head, because I'm not into that. But I was hooked within the first 20 minutes of the show. It's really neat. There's something they're doing in this Debs program that Nick Offerman is running in it that has something to do with, it looks like they may be able to look back through time or something like that with a computer program. I'm not 100% sure, but it's interesting. I think it'll be a good show going through. So check that out as well if you have Hulu, Devs.
Yeah, and I like it when Hulu does this, where they release their shows week to week. I know some people don't like it. They do this with Handmaid's Tale. They did it with Castle Rock, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm sure they do it with other shows too. I don't watch a whole lot of Hulu shows, but they are doing this one week to week, right? So they've aired the first two.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and it's good because, yeah, if they've dumped all these shows, I feel like I'd just never catch up on anything.
I know.
I know. Watching anything else this week?
Well, I have a Riverdale update for anybody who's interested.
Did Souphead come?
No, Dean. Jughead lives. Jughead lives. It was all a ruse. It was all a ruse to foil the Stonewall preppies. So we've got Jughead's alive. The Stonewall preppies, who thought they had killed him or thought they had framed Betty for killing him, foiled once again.
Man, this
story still will go on.
This high school drama is the most intense I've ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've been keeping Jughead hidden in Dilton Doily's sex bunker.
Ugh. That reminds me when one of my students faked his own death to get out of a test for 3 weeks. And then we found him in Johnny Martson's sex bunker. Mm-hmm. It was all okay.
Yeah. There's always a kid that's got a sex bunker.
Yeah. Probably a couple of teachers too, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. We don't like to talk about those though. Well, and then of course I have to give you my weekly update on season 3 of The Masked Singer.
Ugh.
This week, I can't even remember what the crazy outfit was that went home. Oh, the taco.
That's how memorable
it was. The taco was eliminated this week. Yes, there was a singing taco. There's also a singing banana, but he was good. But the singing taco was eliminated. And it was Tom Bergeron, your second favorite America's Funniest Home Videos host.
Yes. Yeah. Interestingly enough, I know somebody who's related to Tom Bergeron, one of my good friends. Yeah.
Well, there you go. I wonder if they knew that he was the taco. Maybe they were just as surprised as everybody else.
I doubt she watches it.
Well, seriously. She will now.
Maybe she does. Maybe she does. Maybe, yeah. Who knows? Who knows?
All right. Let's get into what we're here
for. Oh, yes. Here's what we're here for. Better Call Saul. You know, it is right now the best thing on TV. They chose a good time to air this show. Now I know we're just 8 days away from Westworld starting, so it's gonna be rough for you and me, Dean.
Yeah,
we're gonna have our homework cut out for us. So more to come on that.
I'm still only 20 minutes into my rewatch of season 2 for Westworld.
I haven't even started it. I plan to start it today.
I gotta find some YouTube video that just recaps the season for me. I think.
I don't think that we will be doing, we're not really pulling back the curtain too much right now, but I don't think we will be doing a Westworld recap podcast. We're just going to dive right in like everybody knows what's going on.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Sure. All right. Well, anyway, Better Call Saul, my favorite show right now, for sure. This episode entitled The Guy for This. I mean, this is a line straight from the show, as Lalo does tell Saul, you know, you're the guy for this. But I think that this title also refers to Kim. You know, she was the guy for this too, with what she had to do. Did you have any other insight on that title?
No, you're good.
Well, we open with ants. Yeah. Ants, Dean.
Ants, Jeff.
Ants, Roby. Yeah. The ants are, of course, what the fans of Tell 'Em Steve Dave. So I don't think this was a reference to Tell 'Em Steve Dave. No. This was a very artistic opening. We see ants starting with one ant and then growing to many, overtaking that same ice cream cone that Saul dropped on the ground, or Saul was not permitted to take into Nacho's car a couple episodes ago. And it was an interesting, very artistic scene, beautiful scene. Those were real ants, correct? This was not
CGI. You know what? I watched the opening and I even thought the whole time, I'm like, how do they get it? Like, because it if they were CGI, they're very good CGI, especially for a television show.
It was
And there was, when you see the whole pile of them later, it's CGI, I think. But that one shot of that ant crawling seemed like it was from like a nature doc or something. So,
well, if you listen,
it
to
was
the
a
Better
cool shot.
Yeah, if you listen to the Better Call Saul Insider podcast, they were very, very proud of this. So, and they don't mention CGI. So I think that it is real. They were very proud of the yodeling music that they set it to, and I have to admit, I did enjoy that. It was super artistic. I definitely think that it shows really, it was painting the picture really of how quickly something sweet and good can just be covered by corruption, which is what we're witnessing here in Saul's transformation.
I got that from it, and also even the idea of Saul taking on these criminals and how quickly it can get out of hand to, you know, like all of a sudden he has these petty criminals, nonviolent criminals, and all of a sudden he's getting picked up by Nacho and Lalo and he's in the shit by the end of this, you know, like he, as we'll find out later, once he's in, he's in.
He's in. Yeah. This is a hard one. This is a fun episode, but a kind of a hard episode to talk about with regards to Saul. And Nacho, poor Nacho. All right, the opening credits were the cigarette being ashed into the scales of justice. We've seen that one before. And then we opened on a super nervous Saul in the back of Nacho's car, right where we left him. it was a neat scene, you know, as he's glancing around the car. They take him to see Lalo in an abandoned garage. I loved this meeting between Lalo and Saul. Saul's so nervous. He's so nervous. He thinks that this is some sort of maybe retaliation for his past representation of Nacho, which, do you remember, this was all the way back to season one. And I was reminded of this in the Better Call Saul Insider podcast, that Saul and Nacho, these two characters, have not interacted themselves since season one.
Right.
It's crazy, Dean. It's crazy that we haven't seen these two together. But do you remember the circumstances and how Saul came to represent Nacho in season one?
Did it have to do with the baseball card guy?
It did.
Or the pill
it
guy. Like
yeah, and the Kettlemans.
Yeah.
Julianne Emery, who, of course, played Featherstone in in Preacher. Yeah, but I don't completely remember. Anyway, Saul thinks it's this. Of course, we know it's not. Lalo lets on that he's Tuco's cousin, which then Saul so wisely and craftily asks about their abuelita.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, Hispanic for grandmother. Lalo laughs and says, yeah, Tuco told me about you. You're the guy with the mouth. So Saul is relieved when he's finally told that he's here to help them with a legal problem. They explain to Saul they want him to give Crazy 8 the details of what to say, what not to say, that kind of thing. Saul tries to squirm out of it, suggesting a flip phone instead as an alternate here. Tell him yourself, you know, he suggests. But this is where Lalo does say the title scene, tells him, you're the guy for this. Then Saul says, oh, you know, I'm expensive, and starts doing some quick math, says it's going to be $7,925. And Lalo goes ahead and gives him $8,000 without blinking.
Yeah, Lalo's becoming my favorite character on the show, I think. Because he does the same thing here as he did with Nacho when we met him last season, you know, where he walks into the restaurant, he's back there cooking. Mm-hmm. Well, here he's just like jovially working on this car. You know, yeah. I think even like he makes sure he's like tells him about the car when he first shows up, as just as if he's just walking in on this guy on his hobby or something, you know. Mm-hmm. He's so, you know, friendly, but behind that smile, you know, he's just a psychopath. But
oh yeah,
he's great.
And Saul could sense the danger.
I like the opposite nature of him versus like a Tuco, where Tuco is just like crazy.
Yeah. And do you remember how Saul came to represent Tuco?
Well, remember he was with those skateboarder twins, and they were trying to pull a prank or something, and the grandmother hit them. And so they followed the grandmother to her house, and Tuco was in there and like grabs him and just pulls him into the house.
Right.
And I think just completely brutally assaults the twin kids. I think that was the last time we saw them. But yeah.
I'm going to have to go back and watch season one of Better Call Saul.
Yeah, Lalo's such another great character, because again, you have Tuco, who's crazy. You have Gus, who is, you know, is a psychopath, but he has that stone cold exterior.
He's and now so you stoic.
Have, yeah. And now you have Lalo, who is this almost friendly, charismatic guy, but again, will crawl, you know, up on a ceiling, jump down behind you, and then slit your throat.
He's unpredictable. Lalo's yes. the unpredictable one, which is what really makes him the most dangerous.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else to say about this scene?
No.
So later at home, Kim and Jimmy are drinking beers from their apartment balcony, and Kim is very, very bothered by the empty beer bottle that Jimmy places on the rail. She just can't stop looking at it, and I have to admit, it was bothering me too. I can't handle stuff like that either, so I'm with her on this. It was all I could do to just be like, why? Why did you have to put it there? I mean, it's clearly going to fall, right? He starts to tell her vague details of his day. She can tell he's being intentionally vague. He says, hey, Saul Goodman just had his best financial day yet. And I loved her retort. It's, good for Saul. Mm. And then she grabs the bottle and walks off. What'd you think of this scene?
Their relationship is still just, I mean, you know, it's,
yeah,
it's splitting more and more.
So strained.
And I hate that what Saul, unfortunately, even though he's not intending to, but what he is doing to Kim.
It's devastating. Devastating. So I'm going to keep going with Saul's storyline here for a minute.
Yeah.
The next day, Saul meets Crazy A in jail. He tells him he's his lawyer, gives him a script to memorize. And what I do love is later, Crazy A, it is so evident to us, the audience, that he has clearly memorized a script, because each time he has to restart his story, he starts with the same line.
Right.
Funny that they don't pick up on it. But hey, when I say they, Dean, Hank, and Gomi show up. Steve Gomez and Hank are there. Yay!
We finally dug up those characters. Get it? Because they're buried.
Yeah. We had to dig them up. Yeah. They do not look like themselves from the past. Let me just say, I know this show is doing their best job in makeup and wardrobe and, you know, even camera angles and lighting and everything they can do to make their characters look younger. They've done a great job with Bob Odenkirk, making him look younger than he does in Breaking Bad. But these two, no.
Yeah, when it's 10 years later.
I know, it is.
I mean, hell, at least they don't look like freaking Jesse Plemons in El Camino.
That's right.
It's like, hey, wait, it's only been 2 days, but he's gained 75 pounds?
But I appreciate that these two actors, you could tell they're having a great time. It was a great introduction of them, just kind of seeing them blurred out from behind as they walk into the jailhouse or whatever it is, the prison. Yep. You know, I mean, it was a great introduction. And they're totally awesome. I mean, yes. They are. They're amazing. So they're there to interrogate Crazy A, who now suddenly wants to talk. There's some great lines in there, you know, about how he's yanking their chain and not in a good way.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You can tell Hank and Gomez are, their chemistry is right back where it was, which is nice, but you can tell just how much they already see through the bullshit. And Hank's always been good about that. And even when he meets Saul, you know, he knows immediately, like, oh, that's a fake name. Like, and he looks at him just as some scumbaggy lawyer, which is, I think, the very first time we ever met Hank and that we necessarily met him, but when we, the first time Hank and Gomez are in to, I guess, interrogate Jesse Badger. Is the very first. Oh, bad. Yeah.
Badger. And the same and Saul's way. There, they're so annoyed. It's like, oh, this guy, come on. Yeah. Yeah, so this is representative of the first time
Absolutely.
Hank and Gomi meet Saul Goodman. And you're right, Saul barges in. This is all, of course, the ruse, the script that Lalo intended. We know that. Hank and Gomi don't. But Saul busts in. They say, who the hell are you? He says, I'm Domingo's lawyer, Saul Goodman. And yeah, I loved it. Hank could see right into that name. Oh yeah, this is what you're calling yourself. Okay, great.
Now I don't think we're going to see very much of them moving forward.
No, I heard, again, Breaking Bad Insider Podcast, can't recommend it enough. I believe they're only cast for 2 episodes.
Yeah, because you even think by the time we in Breaking Bad, you know, obviously they have no idea who Fring is because you know, they're all pally with him with the way he is funding the police department and things like that. So I don't think they're going to get too involved throughout the seasons.
It is interesting how there is that they ask Crazy 8 to start naming names. And he dodges that a little bit by saying, you know, he only knows about the drop zones or whatever, because those get kicked up to people he doesn't know about. And that whole subject is kind of dropped. But it is, I thought, well, he's not naming Gus here. We know that for sure. And he's clearly not going to spill on the Salamancas. So it was... even with the beautiful performance, the song and dance that Saul and Crazy 8 do there in front of Hank and Gomi, and then they even agree to let him be an informant, and right. if his details pan out, you know, so they give him a contingency case. That's the word I'm looking for. That if the drops are where they say, where he says they are, you know, then he can be under their protection, be released,
right?
Things like that.
And I'm thinking if we do ever see interaction with Fring and Hank, we're going to at least see him set up the whole Gus Fring Foundation or whatever it is that they, you know, or I can't remember what it is. Or he's just like a big fundraiser for them or something like that. Yeah. So we'll see him kind of be proactive and get in the same way that Saul is hooking Lalo up at, you know, the way he's going to say, like, no, he's a confidential informant. He's your ear into the department now, or he's your mouthpiece. Gus right. is going to work his way into the police department as well, too, so that he Smart. Knows what's going on.
Smart. You know, this did remind me about Breaking Bad. There is a throwaway line. It's got to be between Hank and Walt, where Hank reveals to Walt that he had an informant who's just gone dark, named Crazy. I think he says, I had this, you know, informant, went by the name Crazy Eight. Mm. He's gone, you know, I haven't seen him in several weeks. He's just gone completely dark.
Well, that would make sense considering what happens to him.
Right, because, well, yeah. But I believe this is how we, the audience, are led on, and also through Hank, or excuse me, through Walt, that Crazy Eight was an informant. So right. that was kind of in the Breaking Bad canon, even though it was after Crazy Eight's death that reveal came to us, the audience.
Right.
And I'd almost forgotten about it. But this is the origin story. I have a note in here of how Crazy Eight became a quote-unquote informant for the DEA, right?
The snitch.
I love it. I love it. So later, Lalo is racing his muscle car, the one, the very one he was fixing earlier, and he's making a big show of it. Saul's there waiting to report to him. I love the exchange about the car, and Lalo asking Saul what he drives.
Right.
And Saul says, an Esteem, a Suzuki Esteem. It's it's an import. Do you think that is the start of maybe Saul's realization that he needs a more showier, flashier car? Because we know he's eventually going to be in that Cadillac, right?
Right. I mean, yeah, that's been on the way he's already with the suits and everything.
But
I
Lalo
think that's just
the
natural
up,
progression.
But Lalo straight up car shamed him here.
Yeah.
So this is maybe the start of him like, oh, if I'm going to hang with the big boys.
Right.
You know, because he's constantly going to be teeter-tottering in and out of this world, whether he wants to be in it or not. We're about to get that great line from Nacho. But what I'm trying to say here is, the part of him that enjoys the money and the prestige that is coming along with it is what, and this first line here, this car shaming from Lalo, I think is the first step to going from the Esteem to the Cadillac, right?
Yeah, probably.
All right. So Saul tells him everything, says the DEA, or yeah, it's the DEA's after arrests. And, you know, Crazy A is now a confidential informant, and you're going to maybe hear on the streets that he's a snitch, but really he's not. He's really, really not. So I did like how Saul was, you know, really trying to protect his client here. Then Saul says, you know, I'm really, really too busy for any kind of future endeavors. So you might need to think about somebody else. But Lalo just smiles at him and says, yeah, you'll make time. And then after Lalo leaves, Nacho tells him, it's not about what you want. When you're in, you're in.
Yep.
And that's a parallel to the Nacho situation, which we're about to get into. And then Saul is dropped right back off at the very spot where he dropped the ice cream, and he sees all the ants covering it.
Yeah. And again, it's almost like we said, it's him realizing like, oh shit, this escalated too quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So we're going to come back to Saul's story.
So Saul's the ice cream.
Yeah, Saul's the ice cream for sure. I don't like it. All right. We move quickly into Mike for just a moment. We just get a very quick Mike scene. It's wonderful, though.
Take it down.
Mike is getting drunk at the bar. He tells first, then asks in the most polite way Mike knows how to be, the bartender to take down that postcard of the Russian opera house.
Sydney Opera House.
That's right. Sydney. That's right. It's the Sydney Opera House. This is from last season, the story where Werner tells him that his father built that.
Right.
And so this is Mike clearly, you know, being upset over Werner.
Yeah, absolutely.
And presumably also the way he treated Kaylee and Stacy. Then walking home, he deliberately picks a fight with some thugs on the street. They are taunting him, kind of following him behind, calling him an old timer, Gramps. Saying, give us $20, Gramps. I loved it. He says, I've got a lot more than $20, asshole. And they say, all right, Gramps could throw down. And the first guy who goes to assault him, Mike makes quick work of him, breaks his arm, turns around looking for more. But he has indeed proved that Gramps can throw down. And yeah. Clearly, those guys are not going to tangle with him. So Mike was just itching for a fight. This is Mike. This is Mike's decline, right? More decline.
Yeah, this scene was great. Like, I didn't know what was going to happen because I almost thought, like, is he going to end up killing this guy in front of him? Is he going that far off the rails? Is he going to end up actually getting the shit beat out of him? Because even though he might take out one or two of them, there were like 10 guys.
Yeah.
Like they could have, crazy, if they wanted to.
He could not have taken all of them. Come on.
No, but I do.
Superman.
I do think I think that what that shows is that those guys had no intention to just, like, you know, do anything to him. They were just fucking with him because they were just, you know, all getting drunk and stuff. And once they realized that he's going to easily beat the shit out of a couple of them, once, you know, they were just like, oh, you look like a fool. Let's all go back to drinking.
It was an interesting scene. Not enough Mike in this episode.
But when you said how he's talking to the bartender about the postcard, I even like when he's like, I think you've had enough, Mike. He's like, here's my keys. Put them in the register.
Yeah.
Pour me another drink.
Yeah.
And when he asks, when he does finally, like, you know, I'm asking you, take it down. Please, like, you actually feel that hurt in his voice too. You realize, like, it is hurting him to look at that and think of Werner. So you are seeing that he is just, he hates that he had to kill, like we said, not just kill somebody, but kill someone he looked at as a friend.
Yeah. It's Mike's story is rough. It's rough.
And he really does. I mean, you know, assuming he gets to Breaking Bad, about the same situation he's here now. He never really gets close to anyone again until maybe Jesse.
Yeah, that's true. And that's barely a closeness.
Yeah. And that just starts right before the end for him too. So.
Yeah. Oh, so sad. All right. And it gets sadder. Let's move into Nacho. Nacho's hanging with his girls. One of them is clearly crazy. She is trying to take everything apart, including the Rubik's Cube, and she's taking everything apart with a flathead screwdriver, I guess.
Yeah, that's not crazy. That's just meth.
Taking apart the remote control because she has to take it apart to clean it, of course. Nacho, rather than, you know, try to point out her meth-infused insanity, he just gives her a puzzle to work on. So he's, you know, he's a good boyfriend to these two girls, right?
So she's like, right? She's like the Lenny to his David,
I guess. Oh. Yeah, she's something for sure. And Papa Nacho shows up. Oh, I love Papa Nacho.
Oh, can we call him Nacho Grande?
No. Oh, yes, Nacho Grande. That's wonderful. I just love him. And it's so sad, Dean. It's clearly the first time he's been in Nacho's house. He's unimpressed. You know, he knows where Nacho's money has come from. He meets he meets one of the girlfriends. I guess the crazy one had enough sense to get the hell out of there.
Yeah. Do you think this is the first time that they've actually really spoken since the time he showed up in his house after the fake shooting?
I think so. I think it's been a while.
Because remember, since then is when Nacho's been making the money and moving into this kind of lifestyle.
Yeah. And you can tell Nacho is not proud. He's not he's like, look, Dad, look at everything I've look, Nacho Grande, look at everything I've accomplished.
Right.
He's very hanging his head low in front of his father. And they sit down, have some coffee. His father starts to tell him about how one of his employees has offered him a large sum of money to buy him out, more money even than the company's worth. Nacho's like, oh, yeah, that sounds like a great deal. You should probably go for that. But Nacho Grande's having nothing to do with that, knows clearly that this money is coming from Nacho. Duh.
Yeah.
You know, and then like a proud asshole, you know, they're both being so stubborn here because he just, Nacho Grande says, you know, you might want to run, but I don't run. And just, you know, basically refuses to buy into this. But it just seems like if Nacho would just say, hey, Dad, if you would just fucking get out of town, then I could get out of town and we'd both be free and clear. But the only reason I'm stuck here is because I'm trying to keep you alive, you dumb asshole. His dad is so stubborn.
And we saw this last season too, once Hector was out of the way and Nacho for the short time was kind of running the business, you know, he tells the dad, like, you don't have to worry about the payments anymore. And the dad still goes to the register, gets the money, and gives it to him, because it's almost like he doesn't want to be saved by you getting deeper into this. He doesn't want to be saved by your drug money at this point. So it is that pride, but it's also his way of showing, like, you're not doing this the right way.
Why didn't Nacho say, hey, come with me, come with me, take him back to his little bedroom, secret safe, open it up, go look at all this money I've got. I know you don't like where it came from, but it'll save our lives. And BT dubs, I've got these passports ready to go. Let's go. Why?
Because he's a Nacho guy. He's not a poutine guy. He doesn't want to go to Canada.
Oh, this is not going to end well for Nacho Grande. I am so sad to say.
It's probably not going to end well for Nacho. Yeah.
Oh, it just breaks my heart. Breaks my heart. All right, we'll come back to Nacho toward the end, but let's move into Kim. Kim's doing her pro bono work. She's in court. Looks like I don't know if we're going to see this case again, but this is clearly some sort of case that is going to go to trial, perhaps, where she's defending some young girl whose parents seem very concerned. I don't know that we really got the full scope of what that girl did. But anyway, while she's doing this pro bono work, her assistant keeps interrupting her with Mesa Verde work. And finally, Schweikart calls her and says that she needs to get her butt to Tucumcari, New Mexico. Now, this is actually a city I'm familiar with. My husband's from New Mexico. And so I've visited Albuquerque and that whole area a couple times. It's great out there. But we actually have a mug in our cabinet, a Tucumcari mug. So this is a city I've heard about before, but anyway, I loved it being discussed. It is an odd name city. Fun word to say.
Yeah, it is in the middle of like nowhere, New Mexico.
Yes. And this, we learned that Tucumcari is the site of the future Mesa Verde call center. So there's a large parcel of land that's been cleared all for one house who's holding out. One crazy old man, Mr. Acre.
Yeah.
Kim arrives there. Paige is there. She's so relieved. Kim's the one for the job here to get this crazy old man to come to reason. So Kim approaches him. She gives him the whole Mesa Verde song and dance, the offer that they're even willing to increase now to 18,000. He mocks her, saying, she's the big guns with a ponytail. And he really gets under her skin. So she then starts yelling at him. Who do you think? You think you're special? You know, all of your neighbors sold. This is the law. This is a contract. It's enforceable. You need to deal with it. Screaming in his face, which makes Paige very happy as Kim storms off. Then later, while she's driving, she's getting updates from her assistant on her pro bono cases. And you can kind of see it in her face that she's having feelings about how she treated Mr. Acker. And so she does a very noble thing in my mind. She goes to a real estate agent. We don't see this, but she ends up back at Mr. Acker's house. She's been to a real estate agent. She has a lot of brochures on houses for sale. She's showing him these beautiful houses with great views and great, you know, space that he could have. She even offers to help him pack and move. She's very sympathetic to how difficult moving can be and says she'll even pay for it and take her own time off to come and help. All he has to do is just say when. Then she shares her very sad story of her childhood, trying to explain she understands she's never owned a house. She was so poor as a child, they would have to leave in the middle of the night from place to place, always on the run, sometimes so cold her toes were numb in the middle of the night. It is the saddest story. And in the end, he tells her she'll say anything to get what she wants. And he slams the door in her face. So she bears her soul, supposedly, and is rejected and told she'll say anything to get what she wants, when we've seen her time and time again make up things to get what she wants.
Right.
Did you believe her this time?
I don't know, because that was the whole thing. It seemed as if I looked at him the same way I looked at that dumbass kid from the last episode she was working with, and I think that's why she got so frustrated too. You know, we saw him where he didn't want to take that plea deal because I'll just show my pregnant wife and they'll let me off. And she knew it was the best thing for him to take the deal. And he was too stubborn to do it, or too dumb to do it. I think she at first thought of this guy like that. I think she then realized that, well, maybe he is just like a lot of these other people I'm doing pro bono work for. He can't see that this is the best thing for him. And so she goes to try to plead with him. But yeah, I don't know if we'll find out if that story is true, or if that's her slipping into Saul, you know, like into his tactics.
Her Giselle. That's her, yeah. Giselle, right?
Right. So we'll see. I'm worried about what Kim is going to do. Because that's the more I think about what her future lies with, I'm worried she's going to end up getting into too deep into Saul's type of tactics, that she's going to unfortunately get caught and get punished a lot worse than Saul ever does or ever did.
Or she's going to somehow take the fall for Saul or something. Something bad is going to happen to her.
I'm worried she's going to burn this dude's house down or something like that.
But I do believe her story. I did believe her. And I hated that in the time she chose to bare her soul and tell the truth, she wasn't believed, when after so many times of lying, she was believed. So I love that dichotomy there.
Yeah, I don't know. We've never had any kind of reference to that life of hers before, I don't believe.
I think we've had reference to the fact that she came from an impoverished background. Okay. Because, you know, she had to work her way up through HHM, the mailroom, whatnot. She had all those student loans and all that, you know, the money that HHM was paying for her schooling.
Right. But again, was this, even with that being a true story, was the emotion, that's the more important part. The story could be true, but is she doing like Jimmy did in the courtroom at the end of the season last year, or last season, and just playing it up to try to get what she wants.
I hope that was not a lie. That was a rough story if it was. She had me suckered, so she got me. Final scenes then. Are we ready to move off of the Kim stuff and into these final two scenes?
Yes.
So later, Nacho reports to Gus everything that's going on, just like a good little informant that he is. And Nacho does warn Gus that if he pulls the money from those dead drops, Lalo will know someone talked. And Gus wisely says that the dead drops will remain, even though he is clearly pissed that he knows he's about to lose this money.
Right.
It's like $7 million or something like that. It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
So he's having to let it go to keep his, to keep the information that's coming, to keep it flowing. But this is really not good, not a bad situation for Gus, right? Yeah,
fucking Salamancas, man.
Yeah, they're such a pain in his ass. And then our final scene back on the balcony. Kim gets home. Jimmy's up there this time waiting for her with beers. And she approaches. He lights a cigarette for her, hands her a beer. He's toying around with his own beer, like acting like he's going to drop it and catch it. Like he's kind of taunting her, making her like, woo, woo, are you going to freak out about this too? And instead of freaking out, she just takes her beer and chucks it across the parking lot. And they proceed to chuck all of the beers across the parking lot until the neighbors start turning on the lights. What'd you think of this scene?
I don't know. Again, it's just we kind of been seeing this recurring theme. And this isn't even just the last season and a half of where their relationship's been breaking down. But there's almost always, every time you think that they're done, or you know that their relationship is frayed to the point of no repair, they always end up almost commiserating with each other.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's what Kim hates, right? Because she talked about that in season 4 about, well, you're always losing, Jimmy, you know, and she doesn't want to be like that. She doesn't want to almost wallow in her own self-pity, which is where Saul and Jimmy kind of like to live. They like being the underdog. They like being the loser because that's what motivates them. Whereas her, she doesn't like that. Like, it doesn't make her feel good to get knocked down and then it's the joy of climbing back up. She wants to be better than him. But again, it just shows that at the end of it, she still goes right back to doing that with him, you know, just doing something, you know. I guess it's the same as last year where she seemed done with it and then, okay, let's run a scam again. You know, it's like her way of getting that high back or something with him.
Yeah.
But it's not sustainable.
It's not. It was an interesting way to end the episode. Dean, who broke the most bad in this episode? Hard. I've been thinking about it all morning before we recorded. I don't even know if I have an answer. I'm curious to hear what you say.
I'm going to, although we only see him for about a minute and a half, I'm going to give it to Mike.
Okay.
Because I think Mike, not necessarily broke, but he is breaking. And I think we're watching him unravel. And I'm very curious to see what's going to end up happening. If he's going to go after Gus or someone again, or if he's just going to do something that basically puts him in a situation where he is back in their pockets and he can't do anything about it. I'm thinking he's going to end up breaking the law somehow. And of course, this is where we're going to see the reconciliation between him and Saul, because Saul is going to get called in to be his legal representation. But
it's a good one. Saul seems like the other obvious choice for this episode, but you know, I want to give it to Kim.
Okay.
Because I think she is so full of her own self-loathing by the end, whether the story she gave to Mr. Acker was true or not. She hated the way she treated him at the start of that conversation. Right. I think she has hated in retrospect a lot of the things she has done. I think the pure vandalism of just throwing those beer bottles, because all I could think was like, who's going to clean that up? You know, it was making me crazy. That was pretty bad. You know, I feel like that the beer bottle throwing was the start of the spiraling down that we're going to see from here on out. I don't know that she's necessarily gonna get out of this without just whatever. It's going to only get worse for her. So this is the start of her breaking bad, on her decline from bad to worse,
right,
in my mind. But also I want to give an honorable mention to Nacho Grande, because even though he was really the one who broke the most good in this staying good and pure and true to who he is. But at the same time, if he could have just broken a little bad, maybe we could still save Nacho.
Right.
So hashtag save Nacho, hashtag Nacho Grande. All right. We got a voicemail from Roby that I am going to try to have Tim put into this in post. So if you hear the voicemail, awesome. If not, it didn't work, and we'll keep trying. But thank you, Roby. He also emailed. I'm going to read a little bit of his email. I meant to read it throughout like we did last episode because I liked that format, but I just forgot. Call it all of the flu medicine I'm on. So he says, Jimmy just got paid $8,000. Get rid of that damn car. I love it that he's thinking about the car too. He says, Kim's all about pro bono to feel fulfilled. Jimmy's all about the cash to feel successful. Yep. True, true. Did the contingency part of the plan, or was the contingency part of the plan, or did Saul have to do some scrambling when the agents smelled a rat? That's a good question. So do you think that whole song and dance there in front of the DEA agents was part of Lalo's plan, or because Hank and Gomi showed up, Saul had to do some quick Sauling to overcome that? Like, maybe they didn't anticipate.
Oh, well, no, it definitely wasn't part of Lalo's plan.
Okay. All right. Well, I didn't realize that. Okay. And he says, I didn't realize Barry Corbin was still alive. I miss Northern Exposure. Now, I never watched Northern Exposure. My guess is you never did either, but I am familiar with this actor. That's who played Mr. Acker, Barry Corbin.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. He was great. He was really good. Seems like Kim is actually talking to Jimmy during her why should you get to make the rules speech. Yeah, I got that too. Or talking to herself.
Right, yeah.
Right? Because this guy, this Mr. Acker, sees right through her, right? Right. And he says, did Kim's late night conversation with the homeowner just help prove that she can't help Jimmy either? People who don't think they need help won't take it. Or based on breaking the bottle scene, did it prove that Jimmy's right and Kim should look out for number one? Mm. What do you think?
I think it's like what we talked about earlier. I think it's beyond her trying to help him. And she, at this point, needs to decide whether she wants to help herself or not. And unfortunately, I think Saul trying to help her is not he's not helping her in any way.
No.
She's just not cut out for this. She's not I feel like we have this discussion about a character in all the shows we cover, but Saul he's a great character, but he's not a morally good person. You know, it's shown that time and time again through the seasons. And I think that's why Chuck always resented him too, because he never could just grow up and put the shit behind him. He always has to find the shortcut. He always has to find the easy way out. And to Saul, he looks at that as, that's because I'm the underdog and that's how I got, they're never going to see me the right way. He basically victimizes himself constantly. He is he's the victim culture without the wokeness.
And Kim, I like that Roby says, should Kim look out for number one? Really, Kim has hardly ever put herself first in this relationship. She's always doing for Jimmy, helping Jimmy out of a jam. I guess they do things, quote unquote, for each other.
But it does always end up going toward Jimmy. And even when things are for her, it's his way of doing it. The blueprints, the court case. I mean, everything is... his way of doing it, not her way. Even, you know, even when she got so pissed off about the kid in the court, she still ends up having to do it his way because.
And yeah, and even when she hatched the plan to save Huel, that was only because she knew Jimmy was going to take matters into his own hands, and
right.
she had to do something because he was going to make it worse.
Right.
So finally, Roby says he's going to break bad with Jimmy again. Seems like seems to be Kim's go-to when she's frustrated. Jimmy intuitively senses it and encourages her, probably why she loves him. And he says no payoff on the reason for Mike's blow-up. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if I agree that there was no payoff.
Maybe he didn't understand the postcard.
Yeah, that, you know what? I love this about the Better Call Saul. I almost said Breaking Bad, but I guess they're one and the same.
Yeah.
The writers, they do not hold your hand in this show. They expect people to remember things. As subtle as it was about taking down that postcard, there could have been a throwaway line where he says, you know, my friend's father built that. I just don't want to look at it anymore. There could have been a real easy line to make the audience remember, but no, they expect their audience to remember these things and
take it down.
Yeah. That's why I love it. All right. We have covered this episode. I think we've done it in record time.
All right. So what do we talk about for the next hour and a half?
Right.
We got to fill time at this point, right?
My voice made it through. I don't know if it can make it another hour and a half, but I do hope that when we broadcast again, I do sound a little better. And we are going to try to get the next episode done earlier in the week than later. So that's our halfway commitment to that as of this moment, right, Dean?
Absolutely.
Because we're going to be starting on either two episodes a week as the Westworld coverage starts to take hold, or a doubled up episode. Let us know. Write and let us know. We give all of our contact information. So we're miketvpodcast@gmail.com or on Twitter.
Yeah, you can find us on Twitter at miketv1 or at @Rockdale_Tiger. And give us your thoughts on...
Yeah. Well,
Better Call Saul, any show we're talking about, any show we're not talking about, we'll mention it.
Yeah, sure. Tell us about if you'd prefer us to do Westworld and Better Call Saul in one episode or two separate smaller episodes, which I think will probably be the way we're leaning. So just let us know what your thoughts are on Westworld 2 as we start to come into season 3, which I'm very excited for.
That's right. It's the Westworld Breaking Bad crossover season.
That's right. Well, Dean, I thank you for speaking with me this morning and excited for the next episode of Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
And until then, everybody, I'm Lisa.
And I'm Dean. And make sure you always keep it
thorough.